House Committee on Rules, Elections, and Public Affairs. Tuesday, April 27th, 3:30 p.m., Hearing Room D.
I'll order this meeting of the House Rules, Elections, and Public Affairs Committee. We have a shorter agenda before us today than we've had for a while. Hope the members of the committee appreciate that.
We do.
Okay. What we want to do is open a public hearing on House Bill 3285 and call Representative Winters.
Chair, I have legislative counsel with me today.
Great.
For the record, my name is Jackie Wilmers, State Representative District 31, here in support of House Bill 3285. I asked counsel here because we've received a letter from the governor's office respecting the Ombudsman's bill. And particularly, you have in front of you the Dash 6 Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought counsel in case you might have any questions respecting the letter that you received.
Have you heard this bill once before? And the Dash 6 Amendment are yours?
Yes.
Would you want to run down what the Dash 6 Amendment provides?
The Dash 6 Amendment is pretty much exactly as we had before, except for we changed the concern that Representative Mannix had with the two-thirds, and we modified that. We also changed to make sure that it was clear that the Ombudsman could receive complaints from individuals, and the agency language was put in there so that it was clearly that it was not in conflict with state agency. And those are the only changes that we made on the back here.
Any questions, members of the committee, for Representative Winters about the Dash 6 Amendment to House Bill 3285?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Beyer.
Representative Winters, I'm frantically pitching to you. I'm trying to read the governor's letter and the Dash 6s at the same time. And I see his first thing is that he wants to be able to appoint the ombudsman and confirmation of the Senate. He could support that, it says, he doesn't want to do that, but and I'm refreshing remember, how is your ombudsman appointed?
The ombudsman is appointed by the legislature with consultation with the governor.
So the, Mr. Follett?
Yes, Mr. Barr.
So the president of the Senate and the Speaker of the House would get together and come up with a person, and then they would go and seek the governor's input, is that?
Correct.
What if the... One more, Mr.
Yes, Mr. Barr.
Proceed. What if by some chance that the two of them could never agree on a single person, then what?
It's consultation. The Speaker and that committee could go ahead and appoint the ombudsman. It doesn't take the governor to agree.
Ms. Mulcair, if I might.
Yes, Jane Moss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer. Page 1 of the Dash 6 Amendments, lines 10 through 13, explain that the Legislative Administration Committee has the obligation to select the ombudsman by a majority vote of that committee. So the President and the Speaker are part of that committee, but they aren't the only members.
Mr. Chair, may I have a clarification of who are the other members of that committee?
Currently? Well, I'm a member of the committee, and I don't remember all the members.
It's a shame off you've given me a certain number of people appointed by who?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, as luck would have it, the legislative administrator, Mr. Henderson, is here, so I'm sure has that information, and I don't.
Mr. Henderson.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm going to fire for the record. I'm Dave Henderson. There are, in addition to the Speaker and the President, there are four members of the House appointed by the Speaker, three members of the Senate appointed by the President of the Senate on that committee. Currently on the committee, in addition to Representative Winters and the Speaker, are Representative Harper, Representative Piercy, and Representative Edwards. And on the Senate side, in addition to the President, it is Senator Durkler, Senator Brown, and Senator Tarnow.
All appointed by the Senate President or the Speaker of the House?
Correct.
Okay. And what this does is move the ombudsman off. There are a number of ombudsman offices in, currently set up. This consolidates all that into one office. It takes it out of the executive branch, puts it in the legislative branch.
Correct.
One ombudsman instead of numerous ombudsman. Mr. Scar?
Well, that was my question. We are eliminating ombudsmen that are in the existing agencies.
The plan is to create one ombudsman's office for the state.
So we eliminate those the various ombudsmen that serve through the variety of state agencies.
Correct.
Mr. Chair? Yes,
it's
Beck.
So to follow up on that, look at our list here. It looks like he's presented to us. So let's say there's a workers' comp ombudsman that is costing $928,000. People who've got concerns about workers' comp, I know it's not a very tough subject, but they would just, instead of going to the person that is now expending $928,000 answer the workers' comp questions, complaints, concerns, they would now go to one legislative ombudsman and this $928,000 would go away under this bill.
Well, they would go to one central office.
They would go to one person. This is there.
Yes, correct.
So, and I see the fiscal on the on this bill is $177,000 on one person versus 4.1 roughly to fund ombudsman for all these other agencies.
That doesn't exact that. Let me clarify for you.
Actually,
the long-term care ombudsman is an ombudsman that is funded with both state and federal funds and deals and is under a special category.
Mm-hmm.
The other ombudsman are scattered throughout all the state agencies. The governor's citizens representative, as I understand it, is a part of the governor's office, and they would not like to be included in this particular packet in talking to Anne. But the other activities would then go into one office, and that office would address all issues that affect state agencies, not just those that are listed. It would be no different than when I was the ombudsman, for example, and no matter what complaint came to my office that related to service, whether it was workers' comp, whether it was Department of Transportation, whether it was a human resource issue, they all came into one central office.
Chair, yes, Ms. Newbeck.
How many people live in Oregon, Sharon, would you guess? That's my winner. Half of what it is today?
Probably more than that. But I had, at that time, the staff consisted of an ombudsman, two deputies, and a long-term care ombudsman and administrative ombudsman.
Okay. Mr. Chair,
President Beck,
I want to understand this. Are we talking about shifting all these people and all work they do into an office, or are we talking about eliminating all these people and having these responsibilities filled by one human being?
You're not talking about this being done by one human being, no.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, maybe I'm confused, but I'm quickly trying to scour the bill and the amendments, and I don't see anything that specifically replaces any of the other current existing ombudsman positions, and I want to make sure that that we're all talking about the same thing. I mean, I don't have an opinion necessarily one way or the other, but I want to make sure we're talking about the same thing. Was it your intent, Representative Winters, to have amendments that in fact did eliminate all the other ombudsman's offices and reapportion either those people or those resources into the single office?
Actually, it was my intent. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. I'm not sure that that's reflected in the amendments. I don't know if Mr. Chamoff is the author of the amendments, but maybe you tell me if I'm missing it, I guess, Mr. Chamoff. Am I missing
it? Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, you're not missing it. The bill, the amendment as drafted, the Dash 6, is create an office of ombudsman for the Legislative Assembly, but it does not eliminate or otherwise alter any other offices.
So we may need some further amendments then to actually eliminate the others and consolidate that work, if that's what your intent, Representative Winters, into the new Legislative Ombudsman Office.
If that's what we need to.
Okay.
We could also do that. We probably need to get this half year if there's a way to move it.
Right. Mr.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And this is a question for Mr. Chamoff. We have received any copy of the letter from the governor's office on this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, just before the hearing, yes.
Well, I just got it as the hearing started myself. In this letter, reference to Section 10 of Section 11 is potentially unconstitutional. Could you comment whether the exact six amendments would be constitutional in your opinion?
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, although we understand the issues that the governor's office is raising, we do not believe that the Dash 6 amendments are unconstitutional. We think that the Constitution does allow the Legislative Assembly to create a position like this.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Devlin?
I might ask sort of a classic question about constitutionality. The Ombudsman, Jenny, the Ombudsman Office as created, normally an Ombudsman Office might be able to direct state agencies to provide information or to conduct certain investigations. In that sense, would there be a legislative branch directing a portion of the executive branch to take action, and could that be a separation of powers issue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, as you've described the operation of an ombudsman office, yes, that could be a separation of powers problem. This bill is drafted not to get into that kind of problem.
Representative Winters, the intent that you have is to eliminate the other ombudsman, consolidate them in one new legislative ombudsman office with deputies as necessary to take the place of the others.
Correct.
If you post to hit the work session again on Thursday, do you have time and visit with the style we would get that done? We do. If you have to post it today, if you add it today, we can get that done. Maybe we should do that. And is that the amendment to me, if that's what you would like to see happen? And then I'd be happy to move the bill down to Ways and Means to the other members of the committee agree to do so with me.
Okay. Thank you.
You bet. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3285. There was no one else signed up to testify on this bill today.
Okay. Is Representative Butler available?
He won't be coming down at all. Okay. HR 42. Okay. HR 76. I'll open a public hearing on HBR 76.
Is there a sign-up sheet available? Can I give us a summary of HR 76, please, Mr. Moore?
Insurance Committee members, HCR 76 refers to the people an amendment to the Oregon Constitution to make free speech rights consistent with the First Amendment of the United States Constitution.
Mr. Pedanke?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, David Pedanke, Executive Director of American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. Mr. Chair, I was hoping to be able to testify after supporters of this measure that appeared before you so that I would have some idea of what I was shooting at. I'm not quite sure what is motivating this particular proposed constitutional amendment. I believe the committee is aware that there have been two previous efforts to amend the Oregon free speech provision that have been rejected by voters, measures 19 in 1994 and measure 31 in 1996. Both of those measures were narrower than this proposal in the sense that they were targeted at overturning Oregon Supreme Court decisions related to obscenity and pornography. The effect of this measure would be much broader than that and would affect the free speech rights of Oregon businesses, would affect the free press rights of Oregon news media outlets. For example, under the federal First Amendment standard, it is permissible to go after newspapers and broadcast media for punitive damages in defamation and libel suits, but that is not permissible under the Oregon Constitution. It is permissible to try to recover actual damages, compensatory damages, from a newspaper that has libeled someone or from an employer who has libeled a former employee, for example, but it is not permissible to recover punitive damages for a tort that is based on speech in Oregon. Mr. Chair, I guess I just wanted to raise a large caution flag for you before you pass this particular measure out of committee. We believe that it would be easily rejected by the voters if it appeared on the ballot. Because it's much more broad than proposals that the voters have already rejected twice before.
Mr. Pedanke, thank you for coming in today. You know, I would just offer to you that I don't see people in other states being Muslims.
Well, Mr. Chair, actually, we could cite you numerous examples of local officials who have been overzealous in going after people who they believe were unpopular. Eventually, those actions may have been overturned by the courts. We believe the Oregon system, which makes it clear that regulations cannot be based on the content of expression, but that regulations need to be focused on the negative effects of speech, is a much better public policy, allows the government to go after actions of individuals which are causing a problem rather than trying to engage in prior restraint, which in the end is going to be overturned by the court. We may have very real disagreements about some of the decisions that Oregon courts have laid down based on Article 1, Section 8, but I don't think the way to fix those is this type of a measure. If there is a problem with a particular area where the Oregon Supreme Court has gone farther than you think they should have, I would encourage you to focus on those areas rather than repealing the Bill of Rights, the Oregon Bill of Rights, altogether, which I believe is the purpose of this measure, or at least the effect of this measure with regard to Oregon free expression protections. as I say, that would have implications for Oregon businesses as well as for every other Oregonian. For example, Mr. Chair, under the federal constitution and the federal constitutional standard, commercial speech does not have the same level of protection as political speech. Under the Oregon free expression protection, commercial speech is protected to the same extent as political speech. And that provides greater protection for Oregon businesses than they currently have under the federal constitution. We think that's good. And we would hope that this committee would also think that it's good.
Thank you. Mr. William?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Franke and I have frankly been debating the issue of Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution since 1995, and particularly certain cases by our Supreme Court which broadened its application, in my opinion, beyond what was quite frankly supported, I think, by the historical record. And primarily with respect to the ability we have or frankly don't have now in Oregon to regulate obscenity. Without the benefit of Representative Butler here to tell us frankly what he was trying to shoot at, my guess is that was the issue. I can, you know, simply tell this committee that in fact today we had hearings in the Civil Judiciary Committee again on HJR 52, which is designed to allow local communities to pass ordinances and enact some zoning laws with respect to adult entertainment businesses. I have every reason to believe that that measure will come out of the Civil Judiciary Committee probably next Thursday and will move to the floor. So I think we're taking some appropriate steps. And although I'm still looking for the appropriate time to engage Mr. Fidenzi in a lengthy debate about the wrong turn I think the Supreme Court made in State versus Henry in 1987. I'm not sure this is the proper time or the proper place to essentially do that, Mr. Chairman. But I will say this. On the issue of this being a broader approach and undoing more than just the issue of obscenity and obscene speech, he is correct. This provision would do more than I believe was the focus of the two previous measures that were referred to the voters of Oregon that did fail.
Thank you, Mr. Butler. Other questions or comments within your opinion,
Devlin? Please. Please, bring us.
How about Oregon Constitution is often criticized for being a is often criticized for being a hodgepodge of language that might be better put in statutes than put in the Constitution. But in a fundamental sense, the Bill of Rights portion of it, you know, some of the basics, the freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly, and several others, are probably the most important areas. In your opinion, if we were to actually have something like this that basically simply substitutes the federal constitution for the Oregon constitution for one of those very basic areas, and perhaps maybe even the most basic, freedom of speech is probably the very core of a democracy, shouldn't we have the broadest public debate before we put something out to the public?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Devlin, I think the more we talk about these issues, the better. I believe there's a great deal of misunderstanding about the Oregon Bill of Rights. And one of the things I like in a perverse way about this proposal is that at least it shows the existing language of the Constitution that will be amended, as opposed to some other proposals that are pending in this session or that have been filed as proposed initiatives that change portions of the Oregon Bill of Rights by inference but don't specifically point out the changes that would be made. It's certainly true that the Oregon Bill of Rights is more extensive than the Federal Bill of Rights. It is not at the time of the framing of the Oregon Constitution, the Federal Bill of Rights did not apply to state actions or the actions of local governments. It's only been as we've moved into the 20th century that the U.S. Supreme Court has applied the Federal Bill of Rights to the actions of states and local governments. So at the time the Oregon Constitution was drafted, our state Bill of Rights was our only protection for fundamental freedoms here in Oregon as we became a state. The framers of the Oregon Constitution, I think, took that role very seriously. As we discussed in another committee last week, the religious freedom provisions of the Oregon Constitution are much more extensive than the federal Constitution, which only says that Congress shall make no law establishing a religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The Oregon Bill of Rights has six separate provisions relating to religious freedom that are very specific and very restrictive on the government's authority to impinge on religious freedom. Likewise, this section that protects free expression is much more specific than the federal Constitution's First Amendment and has been interpreted to mean what it says. And we believe that has served Oregon very well. And as Representative Williams mentioned, there are many who have disagreements over the wisdom of particular decisions by the Oregon Supreme Court or other Oregon courts interpreting the provisions of the Oregon Bill of Rights. I think it's much more constructive to focus in on those specific issues and problems and try to solve those rather than throwing out the entire framework of the Oregon Bill of Rights. And one other piece of history, there was concern with another provision of the Oregon Bill of Rights back in the 1960s, the provision that prohibits the state from providing financial support to any religious or theological institution. And after the Oregon Supreme Court held that prohibited providing textbooks to religious schools at state expense, there was an attempt to revise that section of the Oregon Bill of Rights and replace it with the language of the Federal First Amendment regarding establishment of religion. That did go to the voters and was rejected by the voters. So I think at virtually every step when Oregon voters have been asked, do they want to throw out Oregon history and the Oregon tradition of having a Bill of Rights that is independent of the federal constitution, the voters said
I'm going to close the public hearing on
thanks a lot.
Thank you. On HCR 76, and we're going to go on to House Bill 3174. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3174. More of the time to be in the forum.
Mr. Chair, new members, HB 3174, eliminates the authority of state agencies to file proposed legislative measures to shift to a member or committee of legislative assembly. Yes.
Paul, have you heard HB 3174 previously? And we are in work. We will. There's no one signed up. Anyone in the audience who wants to testify on House Bill 3174 today? So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3174 and open the work session on House Bill 3174.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Mr. Starr?
I move House Bill 3174 to the floor with a due process recommendation.
Well, is there a motion to force to move House Bill 3174 to the floor with a due process recommendation? Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Beck?
To help me, someone refresh my memory. This is the one that says every time an agency wants to introduce a bill, they have to go track down a legislator and get him or her to sponsor it.
Yes.
That's what I'm to believe.
Yes.
That is correct. Representative Devlin?
Mr. Chairman, just to clarify, the governor actually still retains the authority to introduce the bill.
Can you elaborate? The governor retains his authority, meaning
the governor can introduce measures to the legislature. This means either an agency, Mr. Chairman, yes. means either an agency is going to have to go to a legislator, get them to introduce the bill, or go through the governor's office and get them to introduce the bill.
Or a legislative committee.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, do we have any statistics about how many bills agencies submit without going through the governor's office?
Yeah.
Versus
do you have any
on their own? Do we have any data on this?
70. There were, yeah. Kind of
maybe a layer there.
Wow.
Thanks, Chair.
Yes, sir.
My next is totally unnecessary legislation. I realize a number of my Democratic colleagues have sponsored it. I just think this is, you know, another victory for people who have convinced a number of a broad swath of society that government is bad and the people who work in these agencies, the bureaucrats, are somehow incompetent or irresponsible or incapable people. And I through maybe as a fault, I have more faith in our government. I think the people who work in our agencies are generally competent, responsible people, and I think to create another hurdle for them to put forth needed legislation in their before the legislative sessions is just another way of nitpicking and bogging down the legislative process. We're seeing it a lot this session in numerous ways by just the lack of involvement that members are taking to involve agencies, and I think this is just another sort of bashing government, bashing bureaucrats, and a product of our modern culture that I find reprehensible.
Thank you, Mr. Jack. You're free to vote no.
Mr. Starr, member of Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that this is a reinforcement of our separation of powers that we enjoy in our state government. And I think it's totally appropriate for us to pass this legislation. I think that if states see a need to change statute, and it's an issue that's important enough that they can, the 60 House members, the 90, or 30 senators, we're all, got telephones and emails and whatnot, we're available. If it's an idea that's worth considering, there'll be one of the 90 that are willing to submit it. And I think that this is appropriate legislation. So I would respectfully disagree with my friend from Northwest Portland.
Thank you very much. President Edwards?
Just to go on record as well, when I testified on this bill, which is not the reason why I was part of the legislation is what was described by Representative Beck, the issue for me is it's a small change. This isn't a big bill, I'll admit that, but it is a separation of powers as was just described. And I think term limits has also raised the question of where the balance of power is going. And I think, again, this is a small one that keeps the balance a little bit in our court. It's a very small change. I'm not suggesting this is going to make a huge, meaningful change in the process here. And quite frankly, I think if you can get legislative buy-in to these concepts, then I think that helps the process. Introducing bills without getting our buy-in, I think right there you're already ceding powers. The power of legislating is the power of introducing is the power to legislate. So I see this more as simply a separation of powers and not, my purpose is not to bash government, to actually make it look better from our side. So that's why I will support it.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to support the bill. I don't quite honestly think other than making it clear, you know, the authority for the legislative and executive branch, that the bill doesn't too much in any way. In a sense, there are no limitations on how many bills the governor can introduce, no restrictions on what he can introduce. I would think that this governor and most chief executives that the state has had have kept pretty good tabs on what bills agencies were approving and probably had approval processes. And probably few agencies ever go outside those approval processes and introduce their own legislation. They probably do at their own risk. So I don't see the bill making a big change other than making people feel more comfortable about the process.
I
Further comments from the committee, Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, I just want to go on record saying that I feel this is unnecessary. I don't think there's any evidence that's been presented that there's a problem with the process in the way that it works currently, and I don't think that this is necessary legislation. It doesn't create a better system, and I'll just simply leave it at that. Let's just go on.
Representative Williams.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I turn this forward.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, I appreciate your help
and your indulgence and your patience.
Mr. Chairman.
Call you Mr. Candy.
Yes, I know you would. I know you would. Mr. Chairman, you know, I've had talks with several people about this bill, and I guess, agree with Representative Edwards that I am not convinced that it's going to make a huge, substantial change in the way we do business here. But at the same time, I do think that there's a certain element of responsibility. The Constitution essentially allows two ways for legislation to be introduced. One is through the governor, the other is through legislators. On the outside chance, and I say outside chance because I'm not confident that the legal argument is a strong one, but on the outside chance that someone could at some point raise a separation of powers issue in a case for purposes of challenging legislation that was pre-session filed by an agency, it seems to me to cover our bases, it's a worthy vote for that reason alone. So I'll support the legislation.
Representative Mannix, do you have a comment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Thank you both again.
Actually, if this is seen as an executive bashing piece, that's unfortunate, and I wouldn't vote for it without the is all of that. I see it as a legislative empowerment and separation of powers piece. I would say that if the Legislative Assembly wants to pass this legislation, however, we also need to be responsible about making sure that members are available to the agencies to file bills, that the committees are meeting frequently so that bills can be filed, and then we are truly carrying out the responsibilities which we're saying that we want to assume through passage of this legislation. What that means is during the interim, we're going to have to see an active legislative assembly that's interactive with the agencies and responsive to those suggestions. With that scenario, then I think we're being responsible. However, I can't control what happens later. I can only control what I do right now. And since I see it as a separation of powers and empowerment piece, I'll vote for it.
Thank you. I just would like to briefly go on record stating that a yes vote for this bill will increase Representative Back's workload increasingly next session by pre-agency filing from the agency.
And just briefly, please.
And I will be voting yes.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to get a clarification on record from Legislative Council. Four officers such as State Treasurer, Secretary of State, Superintendent of Public Instruction, the Labor Commissioner, would their avenues now be either through the legislature or through the governor, and they wouldn't be able to introduce directly as a state agency? And Attorney General. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, as I understand the bill, there would be an opportunity for a recently elected statewide official to operate independently in filing bills, but a statewide elected official other than the governor would be treated as a state agency for purposes of looking through the governor or through a member when not initially elected.
Thank you.
Right. Anybody else?
Okay.
Need a motion, please. Do you have a motion? I think we do. Mr. Wells, if you could call the roll.
Representative Atkinson?
Aye.
Representative
Peck? No.
Representative
Byer?
Aye. Representative Devlin?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Aye.
Representative Gardner?
No.
Representative Mannix?
Aye.
Representative
Piercy? Excuse.
Representative Starr?
Aye.
Representative Welch?
Aye.
Representative Williams?
Aye.
Chair Sidney?
Aye. House Bill 3174 is moved to forward to do pass recommendation. Representative Edwards, which carry this bill?
Sure.
Okay. And I will close the public hearing, the work session on House Bill 3174. And we have before you there should be a bill back. There is an concurrent resolution that we've been asked to introduce as a committee bill. And what's the cost of this? Can we do that, Mr. Wall? Okay, I will open a work session to introduce LC 3820 as a committee bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Mr. Barr?
I move we introduce LC 3820 as a bill from the Committee of Rules and Laws.
I was the motion for us to move the LC 3820 back up as a committee bill from Rules Committee. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so moved. And we'll close the work session. And we'll open a public hearing on HGR 42. And is Mr. Sinceri available? We are trying to check them. We'll call these in order today. How about Kathy Eaton from League of Women Voters of Oregon?
Chair Simmons, a member of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I live in Eugene. I'm the government chair for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. There is written testimony. I just have two or three points that I would like to make. I think the people of Oregon are getting very tired of voting on this particular issue, which is to give administrative rule authority to the legislature, and as far as the League is concerned, destroy the balance of power that you've just been debating in the bill that you sent to the floor. People voted on it in 1996 when it was ballot measure number 27. They voted on it just this last November when it was measure number 65. It's been discussed in the Senate. It's SJR 10 and not favorably received, at least at that hearing. And I guess the question is, why is the legislature requesting to vote on this issue once again? We do feel that this proposal defeats the balance of the executive and legislative branches of government and places it in jeopardy. The legislature makes public policy through statute law, and the laws are implemented through administrative action. This is an important and critical concept of our form of government, and the League firmly believes in the protection of that division of power. When administration rules are being promulgated by the agencies with the responsibility for implementing the statutes, the proposed rules are not developed in a vacuum. There are extensive public hearings over those rules, and the public is given every accommodation in order to place their opinions and their concerns before those rules are finally drafted. Legislators are free to participate in that process. We heard in the Senate hearing about the openness of those hearings, in contrast sometimes to the openness of hearings that are before this body. I've just had a chance to review the amendments that are before you today, which substitute an administrative rules oversight committee for what is the essence of Section 1A in the joint resolution. This further demonstrates a decline in the balance of power because it gives to a 9-member committee the power to rescind or affirm a rule. It can conduct its business on the complaints of 3 people. This tremendously dilutes and narrows the ability of the public to be heard. It takes to just a very small group of people the concern and the discussion and the promulgation of administrative rules, which affect many people. We feel that HCR 42 is unnecessary. We feel there's a good public process now for the development of administrative rules, and we do not believe that the legislature should be involved with the discussion and rescinding or affirming of those rules. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Eaton. Any questions for Kathy Eaton from the committee? Thank you very much for coming today. Mr. McIntyre.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Don McIntyre from Gresham. I don't have prepared remarks, but I think it doesn't take too much. In fact, I would like to spring from the testimony that preceded me. I think it's ironic that someone from the League of Women Voters said people are tired of voting. And especially since the League of Women Voters went to the people to give them a much easier way of self-determination through vote by mail. The issue about the separation of powers is exactly the reason for this particular measure, I believe, and that is that we do have people, professional people in government, in effect legislating through administrative rules. The rules can impose sanctions, they can charge fees, they can impose fines, and all of this by people who are not elected. There has been an explosion of rules, as you know, over the years. That's one of the problems, I think, of modern government, is that we have government has gotten so large and legislators so busy. The legislators come in with a good and worthy goal, something they want to accomplish, and so they generally outline the good that they want to do, turn the power of creating the mechanics of the law to the bureaucracy, and they forget about it. Well, there are citizens out there in business, private citizens, that are sometimes foundering on these rules. When they are abused, they have no channel, no avenue for redress other than the courts, and that's costly and frustrating. So this measure, I think, is a protection for the citizens of this state from government that's heavy-handed. And I think the novel aspect of this particular measure is in the essence of the way it would perform. In other words, if there are complaints, you go to the standing committee of people appointed from both houses, and if they take a look at the rule and say, okay, no, you say that this rule is silly or it's inane or it's costly, we don't think so, at least the majority of the people on the committee, and they vote to continue the rule. And then the nice touch is that those approving the rule have their names added to it. And that will address the problem of non-responsiveness to citizens who feel that they are being abused by the government. They will know who has imposed and who is directly responsible for a particular rule, which I think would be very sensitizing to legislators themselves in seeing that certain elements of their population are held under the thumb of the bureaucracy or not. So anyway, I am, again, I do not think the voters are tired of voting on issues that are relevant, in spite of what the lady from the League of Women Voters said, and she was incorrect saying that we voted on it all the same time, all the same measure. This is different than Measure 45, substantially different, which Measure 45 I thought was very, it was different, and it was another avenue of redress. I think this one is neat, clean, and I hope you do refer it out to the people. Thank you
very much. Question for Mr. McIntyre, Representative Edwards.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I guess I look at this and say, yeah, it is a separation of powers, but I'd say the exact opposite, which is when you say that legislative assembly may authorize all executive administrative state officers, you're basically putting us in the camp of the executive branch. So we pass laws, they pass rules. Now, there are venues to get to problems with rules. There's rules within the executive branch, there's the court, and ultimately you can come back here if you feel that they've gone too far. That's not unheard of. I guess I'm troubled by how much, where the power is going. To me, it's just putting us in their camp. I don't see how this is the other way around.
Well, I'm confused by your analysis. I do not know why we have handed over this to someone who is punching a clock daily for the government, who has not been elected by anyone, to then have the power to impose sometimes arbitrary and capricious and sometimes stupid rules on the public. It's your job to impose stupid rules.
We impose stupid laws.
That's right. And we have a form of redress, and that's the ballot box.
But I appreciate your perspective. I guess I respectfully disagree that thinking that the role of the executive branch, in my mind, is that line of we pass a law, they take the law in the direction and the committee's groundwork that was laid out as to why we're passing the law, and take that, and their power rests in implementing the law. We give them that discretion. That's where the separation
comes in. Representative Edwards, forgive me, but I have seen legislators give too much discretion. And that is what, I mean, you are going to find that this will be an interesting debate. There are plenty of people that would thank you from the bottom of their hearts for having an opportunity, a non-bureaucratic way of being able to come down here and talk to you and make the case of why they feel abused.
One last thing, Mr. I appreciate the faith you have in us in basically putting this in our lap to try to sort through the rules, because I could see this as an enormous challenge. And I'm not sure by putting it with the legislative branch, you're going to solve the problem that you feel is an issue. But
Representative, the reason you see it as a huge burden is because then you know implicitly how many thousands and thousands and thousands of rules have been created by the bureaucracy. One of the salutary effects of this measure will be is that the bureaucracy will probably think a little more carefully before they dream up a rule for people to pay a price for.
Yes, there are lots of things that get mandated on the state by the federal government which this wouldn't address.
No.
Any questions for Mr.
Yes, Mr. Beck? So if we refer this to the ballot, and it fails again, it's different, I know, a little different.
should we just keep trying this one? Should we just get, should we just send something out to voters every 2 years to change the administrative rule?
No, I don't think so. But this seems to be a nagging problem. If people raise the issue, that must mean there's something wrong. I know that from the other point of view, this body, over the years thought we needed a sales tax 9 times. You know, so there are forces contending for the direction of government.
Mr. Chair, if I can comment.
Yes.
How we voted on this how many times in the last 3 years?
I don't know.
To the League of Women Voter testimony in 1996 and then 1998. So 2 times in 2 years we voted on it.
But they were different measures, were they not?
Very similar, though. I think, Mr. Chair, if I may ask.
This is that.
I mean, let's face it. I mean, I think it's somewhat, not straightforward on your part to say that these are dramatically different.
Yeah, they're different.
The details are different. But the intent is the same.
Well, the only one I remember is Measure 45, to tell you the truth. I don't remember the other one.
65, you mean?
The 65? Yeah, 65, that's right.
And Measure 27 was referred by the legislature, the 1995 legislature referred a measure out for the 1996 ballot.
Measure 65 was one that required for a rule to be heard, someone had to actually go out and get signatures. They had to petition the people.
Right.
Yeah, did the earlier bill do that? Well, then why are you saying that I'm being disingenuous by saying they were very similar? They weren't very similar.
Well, not to get into debate, Mr. Chairman, but I think the requirement of 25,000 signatures, we know how special interests who don't like the administrative rule can easily raise.
I mean, the unions?
Any of them. You bet. I mean, they're not free of guilt on this. I'm sure. I guess, when is enough time? I mean, should we vote on assisted suicide again just for the fun of it? Should we vote on a minimum wage again just for the fun of it? When the voters say no or yes to something, when should we just keep referring things back and back until something?
In this state, I can remember, I don't know how many times we would vote on school levies. When the government would never take no for an answer. I mean, but that is our process. And I don't know, unless you think that we ought to just put our political system, set it in granite from time to time.
Mr. Chair, this is a good comment.
You've won one for the fall.
I don't think it's a question, but I just think with due respect, I just think it's a question of timing. I think the sales tax measures we've had, 9 of them, you're right, they've all failed, but over a long period of time, it just seems that we're looking at this too frequently over a short period of time. Every few years, 5 years or so, it just seems like an idea with currency, it makes sense. But to do it 3 times in 6 years just seems crazy to me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
This is sincere.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Ron Sinceri, State Representative, District 22. I'll just be brief with this, and maybe follow along a little bit what the question was. The concern, the reason I have interest in this is because this is a recurring problem, and I think that the people in the public are not made aware of the kind of problem. Administrative rules have the force of law. They are written by people who are not elected by the people. And this legislature, in my judgment, needs to have access to those administrative rules when they are in conflict with what people are doing in our state. And when we have people who are complaining excessively about specific administrative rules, then I believe the legislature needs to have some access to be able to address that. And that's the reason for this. And we'll send it out to the people to let them make that decision. But it would be a relief. And there are instances, and where there have been administrative rules that have been seriously affected what people are doing in their business, what people are doing in their development, and they have no recourse whatsoever. And they couldn't even have recourse once they wait till the next legislative session. So to have a legislative committee be able to set a rule aside if it is creating havoc, it has been unreasonably instituted, I think is entirely appropriate. So we're not asking, as was asked in the last election, for all administrative rules to be reviewed. We're just asking to establish a committee that can abrogate those administrative rules when it becomes clear that it's necessary to do that.
Just two questions for your representative, and I think you started answering it. Is, I guess, how do you determine what would go to this committee? I mean, what's the process by which you would, what do you envision a screening? So it isn't all rules.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, the dash twos would cover this to some degree, but if you have three complaints on a specific administrative rule that comes to any elected official, then the administrative rule committee would be allowed to assemble and to make a determination as to whether or not that administrative rule is out of line. If it is, then they can set that rule aside until the next legislative session, or they can affirm it and say that we don't think that it's unreasonable. You'll have to live with us. But it would take three complaints on the same administrative rule to an elected official to trigger the committee.
Is there a reason this is constitutional? Is there a constitutional requirement that this be put in the Constitution?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, there isn't, but in an instance where you have an oversight like this, and any legislative assembly could undo a statutory requirement, this is something, if the people want protection from rules that are placed upon them as a burden by non-elected officials, then it would have to be their constitution that would protect them. That's that our form of government would establish that.
One last thing, Mr. Chairman, just an editorial on that. I mean, one of the things I'm interested in seeing happen this session is we would try to do annual sessions which might help address this issue in a different way.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I agree and would be in support of the annual sessions, and I think it would go a long way to help facilitate this.
Further questions from the committee for Representative Sherry? Thank you for coming in, David.
Thank you, Sherry.
And then I'll call Randy Pepper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Randy Pepper, 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I usually start out by saying I'm going to be brief, and I'm not always brief, but I think I will be today. Since I did testify on this bill last week, I just wanted to make a couple of comments. First of all, it might surprise you to hear that I actually once have worked with Mr. McIntyre on issues related to initiative rights. We actually did a press conference together. We disagree today, however. I mainly wanted to draw your attention to my written testimony because when I came last time, I cited some statutes and talked about some processes that are now you have on paper, specifically attached to the back of my testimony. It's convenient that he's here today. Mr. Chamoff from the Legislative Council provided this description of the existing process for questioning and challenging administrative rules or for reviewing administrative rules, if I'm characterizing it correctly, that currently exists in the legislature and how infrequently rules are found, in fact, to be inconsistent with the legislative with the legislation that they're implementing. I just like to make a couple of comments now that we've actually seen the amendments. The idea that three individuals or three corporations could, I'll have to look at them to see what other permutation of three beings could request that the legislature actually suspend or rescind, or the committee rescind the force of an administrative rule seems like the bar is set unbelievably low. We vigorously opposed Measure 65 last fall, but the bar there was set where citizens had to go and raise 20,000 signatures. We thought that was bar was unbelievably low. This is almost invisible. I think I'd just like to make my main point, which is if there is a rule that people don't like, that maybe is consistent with the law, but people think it's inappropriate or unwise, the legislature always has the power to pass a statute which undoes that rule. That's all it takes. You can do that any time you're in session. As I've indicated, there are numerous other ways to challenge rules already. As Mr. McIntyre said, the legislature is giving too much discretion to the agencies to write the rules, well, I think that might be something that could be achieved, could be addressed through legislation as well, through the way the legislation is written. I'll stop there because I think you've got my comments on paper. I just wanted to draw your attention specifically to the details of my written comments.
Mr. Starr?
Just have one question.
Yes.
Do you know how many votes were cast in the last November's election?
For Measure 65, it was approximately 1 million.
How many? So
in the election measure, we try to get, because you're asking, in the Measure 65 election, there were approximately 1 million votes cast.
So
something like that.
So a change of 25,000. You said here that was margin of over 50,000 votes. Was,
right.
To me, that was not clear.
It was about a 5% spread, and you know, considering how confusing the measure was and how low profile the campaign was, we felt that that was, you know, a fairly clear result, as well as the fact that a similar thing had been voted on 2 years before and dramatically smashed.
My only response was the earlier version went down 3-1. This one barely lost.
Right.
And seems to me that people are starting to understand a little bit clearer what this issue is about.
I would respectfully suggest, Representative Starr, that very few citizens understood Measure 65. In fact, if you went out on the street and asked anybody about it, you know, it got no media coverage and it had a very low-profile campaign.
Any other questions for Mr. Tucker? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else here who would like to testify on HCR 42? Seeing none, we'll close public hearing on HCR 42. We'll open the public hearing on HCR 67. John McIntyre, you want to come testify on HCR 67?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I just make a few brief comments. Again, I think this is a measure that would give the people of the state a little more security in the direction of governance. I'll just give you one anecdotal example of my experience, and I think that just about everyone else has experienced the same thing. In a Multnomah County election not too long ago, I looked at my ballot. There were 15 judges to vote for. None of them were opposed. Beyond that, the voters go into the vote. They see one name. They don't have a clue about the philosophy of that judge, the temperament of that judge, the life view of that judge, which could be critical because the Bar Association, the canons of the Bar, don't allow a discussion of judges' perspective. So this idea about none of the above is not new. And in fact, there's a similar system in Missouri. They call it the Missouri system in the election of judges. It's not quite the same as this, but it is essentially the same sort of a protection. One of the reasons I believe that judges are not opposed is because of the tremendous power they have over the people who would run against them. I mean, I can't speak for lawyers. I'm not a lawyer, but I think there are a lot of lawyers that would maybe think about running for a judge position, except they know that if they lose, they may have to practice in front of that judge or his friend. So I think this is an excellent referral to the voters, and I think it would pass, and I think it would be a breath of fresh air.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
McIntyre.
Yes,
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. McIntyre, but if there is a judge you disagree with his particular, you know, rulings on any particular case, you or any other citizen of the state is available to go out and find someone that, you know, you think would be better to run against that judge.
Very, very difficult. I've been there.
You've tried?
I've been there, yes, absolutely.
In fact, I know a good lawyer that wanted to throw his hat in the ring for Supreme Court and backed off because he knew he didn't have a chance because he couldn't articulate his point of view. Because the bar won't let you.
This is Edwards.
Thank you. I'm just curious about sort of the none of the above thought there. Is that to try to, for those who don't know,
yes.
And you know, it is sort of hard to understand the cloak of the judicial branch often in judges, but is it the idea that you at least have something else to vote for or beyond just the one candidate?
So, from my point of view, I think there would be a benefit in sensitizing a judge to perhaps, let's say that there's an arrogant or an elitist judge, an imperial judge, and he doesn't care what anybody thinks, he has his own particular view. If he knew that his decision may annoy a significant amount of people, it may sensitize him a little bit more to the feelings of the people that his decisions are affecting.
Just so I understand that point, one way to do that would be, currently you can count undervotes. I mean, in a lot of ways, a lot of people probably may not even fill that out. I don't know. I mean, I personally fill it out, but by having a none of the above, they're basically running against something. Is that sort of
idea here? Yes, they are. If a judge makes a, well, to use vernacular, makes some kind of an idiotic decision, turns a serial rapist out too soon, or turns him out at all, and somebody is affected by that decision, that one or two few people may be able to mount a campaign and say, anybody but this guy.
In Missouri, how does that work pretty well in Missouri? Is that addressed, the issue you're talking about?
Well, it's been in Missouri for years, so I assume it works well.
Thank you
very much, Mr. Chair.
Further questions from the committee? Mr. McIntyre, if we were to consider this or some other method to broaden the public's choice of judges, are there any other ideas that you've heard floating around out there that may be beneficial for this committee or the legislature to consider?
Well, actually, I have heard that there was a piece of legislation floating around in this building that had to do with prohibiting the bar from disallowing debate on issues in campaigns, but I don't know the status of that. But I think this would work well, I really do, and I'm in favor of it. I think the citizens would appreciate it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
With that, we will close the public hearing. You had a question, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chairman, no, before the end of the hearing today, I need to put this in.
Okay.
Not this hearing, but the committee, of course.
Okay. We will close the public hearing. I ask you 60 seconds, Mr. Devlin.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to clarify, the Legislative Council was good enough to inform me that when I asked a question previously about whether other statewide elected officials could still introduce bills, and the answer was given that they would be limited. In reality, there is an exception in the bill that we considered, and they would be free to introduce bills just like any other statewide elected official. Is that a fair?
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Devlin. As you know, the business for the committee, we are adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That moves it all right.
Mm-hmm. We didn't know we needed to vote on the.
Well, we have to vote.